horse with a monkey on its back attacked by fierce dogs. The poor beleaguered horse would gallop and kick. The monkey would scream. The audience would roar. When the exhausted horse collapsed and was killed, it would be time to bring out the bears and bulls, tie them to stakes, unleash the dogs, and repeat the fun. "This sport," remarked a visitor from the continent, "is not very pleasant to watch." In the churches, psalms were sung, and Mass was celebrated not in the time-honored Latin, but in plain English. The Reformation had left other, more tangible marks as well. "It is a pitiful sight," wrote an Italian merchant who kept a journal of his visit to London in 1562, "to see the beautiful marble statues of saints and other decorations there broken and ruined because of their heresy." In the streets, foreigners were advised to keep a low profile, since the crowds could be suspicious or hostile. Even hospitable encounters could cause considerable bafflement. If you were invited to dinner, you had to brace yourself. "It is almost impossible to believe," remarked the merchant, "that they could eat so much meat. To wash it down, the English make a drink from barley and the seeds of hops, which they call beer, healthy but sickening to taste." Compared to Italian women, English women seemed unnervingly free. They could go out of the house by themselves, unaccompanied by their menfolk, bustle about in the markets and serve in shops, even go by themselves to public entertainments. "They kiss each other a lot," observed the merchant of the men and women he was observing. "If a stranger enters a house and does not first of all kiss the mistress on the lips, they think him badly brought up." And yet at the same time, women deemed to be scolds could be literally muzzled by a horrible device called a brank, and anyone suspected of sexual immorality could be publicly whipped and shamed. It was disorienting. The mansions along the Strand and the handsome Royal Exchange in the city center gave way almost at once to a vast warren of tenements and hovels. Half-timbered buildings with dormers and gables extended out over the streets, blocking the light and forming malodorous tunnels for the carriages and pack animals and pedestrians to pass through. The narrow lanes were filled with excrement and offal. On London Bridge, alongside shops for luxury goods, the severed heads of convicted traitors were stuck up on spikes for passers-by to contemplate. On the gallows near Tyburn, there were public mutilations and hangings almost every day. The people spoke a language largely unknown to the rest of the civilized world. Virtually nothing written in English had aroused sufficient interest to merit translation into one of the dominant continental languages or into Latin, the shared language of learning. Early in the century, an Englishman, Thomas More, had published a brilliant short work in Latin, Utopia, that quickly earned him Europe-wide acclaim. But More had been beheaded by the merciless King Henry VIII. Two gifted poets in Henry's court, Thomas Wyatt and Henry Howard, Earl of Surrey, had some success importing and adapting Italian and French poetic models. Wyatt introduced the sonnet form into English, but they too were both snuffed out. Accused of treason, Surrey was executed in the Tower at the age of 30, and Wyatt, who had been imprisoned on suspicion of having had an affair with Henry's second wife Anne Boleyn, died at 39 in the wake of a second imprisonment. Their deaths seem to have had a chilling effect on cultural life. In 16th-century Italy, the major universities were all sites of extraordinary achievements. The founding of the first botanical gardens for the scientific study of plants, epical advances in anatomy and embryology, the positing of germ theory and the creation of epidemiology, a revolution in physics and astronomy. The two English universities, by comparison, were scientific backwaters. Learned scholars lectured on the ancients Aristotle, Ptolemy, and Galen, but new frontiers of inquiry were kept shut, and the attention of teachers and their students was focused elsewhere. Both Oxford and Cambridge were riven by bitter conflicts, as the ascendant Protestant authorities tried to eradicate any residual loyalty to Roman Catholicism, and as more radical Protestants complained that the Reformation in England had not gone nearly far enough. The religious conflicts had been going on for more than a half century, ever since Henry VIII's break with Rome, and in their murderous tangles they caught up the lives and fates of virtually everyone in the kingdom. Officially, at least, the ruler's religion was the religion of the entire country. No other faiths were tolerated, neither Judaism nor Islam, of course, but also not any version of Christianity other than the ruler's own. In making himself the supreme head of the church in England, Henry's interest lay principally in getting his hands on a divorce and on the wealth of the monasteries. The six-year reign of his son Edward VI, who came to the throne at the age of 10, inaugurated a sharper turn in doctrine and